Good evening, everyone. Thank you again for joining our Religious Zionism series. I'm hoping that today's class will be the last of the purely theoretical portion of our series. In the last few classes, we began by studying the Zionism of Rav Kook, Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Kook, and then discussed some of his children and his students and how they sort of employed his more spiritual messianic Zionism. Last week, we discussed the approach of Rabbi Yaakov Yitzchak Reines, the founder of the Mizrahi movement, who had a very different approach, a more pragmatic approach, one which very much focused on nationalism as classically understood, as the importance of getting the nation together in a land, in our homeland, so that we can take care of each other and protect ourselves against anti-Semitism and persecution. And today I want to study a similar approach, right, which I think is actually radically different, and that is the approach of Rabbi Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik, also known as the Rav. And I think it will be very enlightening. But I'd like to begin our discussion with a question. And the question is as follows. Let me pose it in this way, and I'd like you to think of it specifically given the sort of more pragmatic approach. And that is that the original intent of the Zionistic movement was to establish a national homeland for the Jewish people in the land of Israel. So that was a really important movement. And in a sense, you could argue it was successful, because thank God that happened in 1948. The state of Israel was indeed established. So my question to you is, now that there is a state of Israel, and there has been for 70 plus years, what is the goal? What is the overall motivation of the Zionist movement nowadays? And as religious Jews, what do we see as the primary motivation for our continued support of the Zionist movement nowadays? We have a state already. So what's the goal? What are we still trying to accomplish? What do you think? How might you answer that question? Thoughts? After all, you know, I still definitely, I would say, identify as a religious Zionist. I imagine that many of us here would. That's why we're all at the religious Zionism class. Although it's totally open to all those who do not identify in that way. So what are we doing? Well, what's our goal now that we have a state? It's done. It happened.
Well, I just beg to differ in the sense that certain things have to be continuously activated. You have to activate them, and you have to supervise them. Otherwise, if you don't, they'll just disappear because things don't work on their own. Things don't. Everybody has to take a certain responsibility for the continuance of the state. Having the state is not enough, because it can disappear if we stop being observant. I mean, observant of what's going on.
Perfect. So Martin suggests, I think it's very plausible, that essentially our goal is maintenance, yep, ensuring the continued survival of the state. And, you know, the events the last few months clearly give us reason to suspect that if we don't do that, there is no guarantee that it will continue to survive. Certainly, there are attacks internally. There are attacks on the ground from Israel's enemies. And even politically and ideologically, we certainly experience a lot of very strong anti-Israel sentiment. And one could suggest that the goal of the movement now is to make sure things continue. And I think that's really important. I think that's an important answer. So I'd like to, let me rethink about this question, and I'd like to reframe it thinking about the philosophies you learned until now. And I would argue that it's a much stronger question if you take Reines' more pragmatic approach. Meaning, If you take Rav Kook's approach, I don't even think this question gets on the ground. Because for Rav Kook, or for the more spiritual, even messianic approach to the state of Israel, it is not simply about political autonomy. That is a small step in the realization of a much bigger dream. Now, it is inherently significant that there is a state of Israel, because that is an expression of what it means to be a Jewish nation. To be a Jewish nation means to have our own people on our ancestral homeland, the Holy Land itself, the land that God chose. And that allows us to then continue to express all the Jewish ideals of our people and of our Torah, the national ideal and the divine ideal that Rav Kook loves to talk about. But the job isn't done until Mashiach comes. But the job isn't done until that Sanhedrin that Rav Kook dreams about is here. The job isn't done until we find a way to merge these two different schools of secular Zionists and religious Zionists, and the physical needs and spiritual needs are seen to be two sides of the same coin, and that unity is accomplished, right? So if you take a certain spiritual approach, clearly there is so much more to be done. But what if you don't take that approach? What if you're more pragmatic, right? What if you're more interested in continuing to maintain a state so that we can guard against things like anti-Semitism and persecution and ensure the spiritual and physical well-being of the nation? So I think it's a stronger question that way. Then, because if the thought was that the way to guard against anti-Semitism is to establish a state of Israel so that we can protect ourselves against persecution, so that we can look out for each other, then two things I think arise. Number one, now we have a state. And then number two, it's not necessarily so that that's true, because clearly anti-Semitism ain't over, right? Anti-Semitism was not solved via the foundation of the state of Israel. And clearly there's more to it. So I think this is an important segue into the thought of Soloveitchik on this matter. And with this, we'll begin our slide. Now, a bit about, before we get into some of the crux of the issue here about where Soloveitchik thought about Zionism, a bit of an introduction. I'm sure many of us have heard of Soloveitchik before. I'm not going to give a full biography of such a monumental figure in Jewish history's life in just a minute or two, but let me try to explain why it matters what Rabbi Soloveitchik thought about Zionism. Rabbi Soloveitchik, or Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik, the Rav, was almost inarguably the most important figure in religious Zionism and modern Orthodoxy in the latter half of the 20th century. He was not just a great rabbi, not just a great Talmudic scholar, not just a great leader, but the leader of modern Orthodoxy. He was what I would call a gadol. A gadol in the sense that if Rabbi Soloveitchik thought something, then that gives that legitimacy. For instance, if Rabbi Soloveitchik thought that it's important to advance, and I don't want to get into this, it's not the topic today, but just giving an example. Once Rabbi Soloveitchik began teaching advanced Talmud to women, which was a controversial move at the time, then that became something that modern Orthodox institutions could do. Because Rabbi Soloveitchik was the polymath, the prominent leader and thinker in the modern Orthodox world, in the world of Yeshiva University and the Zionist world. And so therefore, it's understandable why over the last few years, and even decades, there's been a lot of heated debate about what exactly Rabbi Soloveitchik thought about the state of Israel and Zionism. And I'd like to explore that with you tonight. And hopefully it will gain us some insight. So a bit of a background, though, is that Rabbi Soloveitchik came from a classical, prominent Lithuanian rabbinic family. Both his father and grandfather were world-renowned Rosh Yeshiva, known as the Beit HaLevi. That's his grandfather and Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik. Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik was his grandfather. The Beit HaLevi was his great-grandfather. And Rav Moshe Soloveitchik were all prominent Torah scholars, world-renowned in the ultra-Orthodox world. And therefore, he came from a family which were not Zionist in their upbringing. His father was not a Zionist, although it's interesting, he did teach in a Mizrahi school in Russia, but the classic traditional Lithuanian approach to Zionism was, we have to stay away because the people who lead the movement are secular. They don't keep the Torah mitzvot. It's not kosher. And therefore, this was a move, a shift that Rabbi Soloveitchik made in his life. And he did not grow up as a Zionist at all. However, it doesn't take long till after he moves to America that he becomes not just a Zionist, but the leader of the Zionist movement in America, certainly the religious Zionist movement, and the leader of Mizrahi as well. Now, there is a bit of debate. I don't want to spend too much time arguing about this now, but there's a bit of a debate as to what really triggered Rabbi Soloveitchik's shift toward the Zionist movement. There are those who claimed that it was essentially anti-Semitism and World War II. Rabbi Soloveitchik he was born in 1903, and he lives through both World War I and World War II. Many of his cousins were killed in the war. He escaped from Europe before the war to Boston in the 1930s. But clearly that had an incredible impact on his life. And some have argued that that's the sort of what got him thinking. But Rabbi Seth Farber, in a piece for tradition, I guess I didn't link it here, but I'm happy to provide a link if anyone is interested, argues that it's not so. Indeed, Rabbi Soloveitchik joined the Zionist movement because he believed in the movement, because he believed in what it stood for. And if you look at his quote here, which is in a speech that he made to Mizrahi, where he highlights the fact that this was a big shift in his life, I think that you see that. And you think you see some of the beginning of his philosophy here. The drasha reads as follows. I was not born into a Zionist household. My parents' ancestors, my father's house, my teachers and colleagues were far from the Mizrahi religious Zionists. If I identify today with Mizrahi, which is in opposition to my family tradition, it is because, one, I feel that the divine providence utilizes secular Israelis as agents to conduct its grand plans in the Holy Land of Israel. Now, that might not be the most complimentary statement about secular Zionists, and Rabbi Soloveitchik was not as warm to secular Zionism as Rav Kook was. I don't think he meant it in an insulting way, though. He's responding to a critique, and I think it's important to think about this for a second. Many criticize, and I will get to this, the Zionist movement, because it goes against certain beliefs about identifying with the Jews who don't keep Torah on mitzvot, about how redemption should work. And Rabbi Soloveitchik's belief was that in the realm of philosophy, divine providence is the primary determinant. Meaning, we could argue whatever we want to about whether it's appropriate to support the state of Israel. But given what has happened, given the history that has occurred in the 20th century and beyond, and given the fact that it's happening, it's really not worth debating. It's happened. Divine providence has ruled that there is going to be a state of Israel. And therefore, he argued that there's no point of continuing to oppose the movement. He also says another point. I also believe that without the Mizrahi, there would be no place for Torah in Israel. I built an altar upon which I sacrificed many hours of sleep, doubts, and deliberations. Meaning, we have to do what we can to imbue it with Torah. And he says, finally, the years of Hitler's Holocaust, the rise of the state, and the accomplishments of the Mizrahi in the land of Israel convinced me the just path of our movement. So he highlights here how this is a shift for him. But maybe the greatest proof that Rabbi Farber musters for Rabbi Soloveitchik's conviction about Zionism, even in the early days, is the remarks here at this rally in 1939. And just to note, what we know of his thought on Zionism is mostly from speeches, right? Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't write some sort of comprehensive, systematic approach to all these considerations. What he did was give a lot of important speeches. And his speeches were really remarkable. He was an incredible orator. And so we have the remarks that he gave at various rallies and Mizrahi conventions and things of that nature. So when we read them, on the one hand, it's very valuable in terms of his Torah thought. On the other hand, when you give a speech, there's a sort of poetic license. You get to exaggerate a little bit. You get to use certain metaphors. to interest your audience. And therefore, it's not a perfect representation always. But here's what he writes in 1939. In 1939, historically, was a very challenging time for the Jewish people generally. It's the advent of World War II, the very beginning, but also for Israel, because in 1939, in the government of England, there emerged a certain document called the White Paper. The White Paper, very briefly, ostensibly, very much limited the rights of Jews in the homeland, in Israel. It's almost a response to the Balfour Declaration. There were riots in Israel from 1936 to 1939, riots by the Arabs in the region. They were very upset about the Balfour Declaration. They were very upset about Jewish immigration. And the government of England essentially argued in this paper that we can't allow a state in Israel if it's going to make and displace the Arab population, one. And two, we should severely limit immigration if immigration is going to ruin the Arab economy. That's a very simplistic argument. And obviously that upset the Zionist movement at the time. And here's Rabbi Soloveitchik, a few of his remarks in 1939 in Boston against the White Paper. He argues, together with the entire Jewish people, we announce triumphantly today, again, before World War II really got horrible, we announce triumphantly today, Monday the 4th of Sivan, May 22nd, 1939, that our rights to the land of Israel did not originate with the Balfour Declaration, and they will not be lost because of the treachery of the British. Our right to the land of Israel began with the covenant of God, with Abraham, our father, and continued through the promises and guarantees to our forefathers and prophets. It is based on the Torah of Moses and in the eternal books of the Bible. We value the land of Israel not only from the political and ethical point of view, but also from a religious perspective. The truth is that from a political ethical perspective, this is a desecration of a martyred people who have been chased and brutalized with no one offering them refuge. They don't even receive the benefits afforded to animals. And he quotes the pasuk from Tehillim, "Ye, the sparrow hath found a house and the swallow a nest for herself where she may lay her young." Oh. And so even animals have a place of refuge, but the Jewish people don't. But that's not it, says Soloveitchik. Essentially, it's not just about combating anti-Semitism. It's not just about ethics. It's about a promise that God made to our people. But the land of Israel is not only a refuge for us, but a place of holiness. The return to Zion is the beginning of the redemption, is closely tied to our holy faith. Our prayers are connected and directed to the land of Israel. Any attempt to weaken the building of the land of Israel is considered an attack on our faith. So clearly here you see that even from before World War II, Rabbi Soloveitchik bought into the religious Zionist vision of the land of Israel as a home on a religious level for the Jewish people. However, here's the controversy begins, okay? Because many have argued that Rabbi Soloveitchik's quote-unquote religious Zionism is not that religious after all. What do I mean by that? He doesn't have the same sort of outlook that Rav Kook has. He doesn't speak of the incredible holiness and spirituality latent in the land. He doesn't talk about the notion of Reshit Smicha Gulatenu at great length, how this is the beginning of our redemption. And he doesn't even really seem to embellish the notion of, you know, spiritual growth connected to the land of Israel per se. It seems more that he's pragmatic. He's interested in practical things, right? Just reading briefly here, a few quotes to this effect. This is a paper from an article by Dr. Eitan Holzer on tradition. Tradition is the periodical of Jewish thought that the Rabbinic Council of America puts out. Our esteemed Rabbi Rabbi Chaim Straffler is the associate editor of tradition. And the Rabbi Holzer writes as follows. Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik is identified by his non-messianic approach to religious Zionism. Gerald Blitzstein, you can look at the link there, questions whether Rav could be identified as a religious Zionist thinker at all, given his overall lack of theological attention to the subject. He concludes that evidence from the Rav's works, even Kol Dodido Fake, which we'll get to, which contains phrases like realization of hopes and full actualization, is that the Rav's Zionism was not messianic, but rather pragmatic. Rabbi Soloveitchik argues Professor Blitzstein and others is not seeing this as the realization of some sort of redemptive vision. It's pragmatic. It's there to protect us. And indeed, many are frustrated with this. Many religious Zionists in Israel are frustrated with this, as Avram Wolfish writes. And again, the link is here to his article. The Rav rooted Zionism firmly in peoplehood, interpreting the divine knock, something we'll get to, as a call to reassert the values of Brit Goral and Brit Yud, the covenant of fate and covenant of destiny, which we'll define later. And here's the point. Neither statehood nor land are accorded values as independent religious goals. It's not that having a state is independently religiously significant. It is not an end unto itself, in the Rav's thought. That this is what many have claimed. While many in the religious Zionist camp resonate deeply to the Rav's brilliant development of the values of peoplehood, I believe that the vast majority of religious Zionists, especially those who actualize their Zionism by living in Eretz Yisrael, feel land and statehood to be integral parts of their religious Zionist commitment. Meaning, many who live in Israel see living in Israel as an end unto itself. It's part of their identity. It's not simply a means to an end. And so there's a certain frustration with the Rav's Zionism. And it's more than that. It's more than that. And I want to move a little quickly here because I don't want to focus so much what the Rav doesn't say. But take a look at this here. This is a quote by Rabbi Ziegler. Again, the article is available in the link in the slide, in which he talks about Kedusha, sanctity, according to Rav Soloveitchik. Now, when you and I think of sanctity, the fact that we say Eretz Yisrael is Kadosh, it's holy, it's a holy land, what do we generally think about? I think of things that are inherent. It's holy in the fact that it's more godly, as it were. It's closer to God. There's something inherent about the land itself that makes it holy. For Rav Soloveitchik, and this is his worldview, it's not so. It's not about some sort of quality that God imbued in the land of Israel. It's historical. It's because we were there. It's because it's a place where many important things happen. It's not inherent. And he writes here, for Rav Yehuda Halevi and the Ramban, their attribute of Kedusha, holiness ascribed to the land of Israel, is an objective metaphysical quality inherent in the land. And he says, I don't agree. With all my respect for the Rishonim, I must disagree with such an opinion. I do not believe that it's halachically cogent. Kedusha under a halachic aspect is man-made. More accurately, it is a historical category. So Rav Soloveitchik is arguing that it's not that Eretz Yisrael is holy, holy in and of itself. It's not that there's something special about the land because God made it holy. It's holy in the sense, and this is what holiness is. Holiness is man-made. We make it holy via our actions in the land, via the history of the land. It's the land of our forefathers. It's the land of the Akedah. It's where the temples were. So it's a historical Kedusha that we bestow upon the land, but it's not that God made the land of Israel more holy than the land of Canada or of Australia. Now, you can understand why for people who had sacrificed a lot to move to Israel because of Kedusha and Eretz Israel, to hear that it's not inherent is a bit disappointing, but this was the Rav's worldview. So what I'd like to do now is explore two very important speeches about the Rav about Zionism. And the question is the Rav a religious Zionist? I'm going to argue, although he is not in the same camp as Rav Kook and his followers, he is a religious Zionist. And I'm going to argue that the Rav is very, his perspective is important in terms of how we need to think about Zionism today. Now that the land of Israel has been settled, now that we have a state. So the first important speech about the Rav gives about Zionism is called Kodo Dido Fake. Kodo Dido Fake means the voice of my beloved knocks. And the Rav talks about a metaphor illustrated by the following psukim. He writes as follows. The following psukim are from Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim is, of course, a love song between the lover, between lovers, between the lover and the beloved. And it's understood by the sages to be a love song between God and the Jewish people. And there's a very poignant scene which he focuses on. Take a look at this excerpt from Shir HaShirim chapter 5, which writes as follows. I was asleep. This is the woman talking. My heart was wakeful. Hark, my beloved knocks. So there's a woman here, and she's sleeping, awaiting her beloved, and she's in her bed. Let me in, my own, my darling, my faultless dove. For my head is drenched with dew, my locks with damp of night. So the lover knocks in the door. And the woman who was waiting her beloved sleeping in bed. And she says, I had taken off my robe. Was I to don it again? I had bathed my feet. Was I to soil them again? She says, ah, you know, I'm in my bed already. I took my clothes off. Ah, it's not okay. My beloved, who I anxiously awaited for, is at the door. But you know what? It's too much to get up right now. My beloved took his hand off the latch, and my heart was stirred for him. All of a sudden, the beloved runs away, starts walking away from the door. And Knesset Yisrael, portrayed in this vision as Hashem's spouse, realizes she lost the moment. I rose to let in my beloved. My hands dripped mir, my fingers flowing mir upon the handles of the bolts. I opened the door for my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. I was faint because of what he said. I sought, but found him not. I called, but he did not answer. So this is a vision of the beloved running away after the moment, the opportunity is lost. And the metaphor that Rav Soloveitchik employs is that the founding of the state of Israel is, of course, God knocking on the door. Knocking on the door, and it's upon us to respond. And he identifies what he calls six knocks, six ways in which God has knocked on the door by establishing and by creating these moments in history which created the state of Israel. Six knocks. Now, here's the thing. I'm going to briefly summarize this, and you should read it inside. It's really beautiful. And I want you to tell me if these six knocks are religious in nature, are spiritual. Say something special about a state in Israel specifically. Number one, he says it's a miracle in the political arena. He argues it's a political miracle that the UN agreed to the formation of the state. The UN, which he argues in his speech, which has done nothing possibly ever useful in its entire history, except for in this moment, the UN filled with nations who despise the Jewish people, got together and actually declared a state. That's a knock. That's a miracle, whether an open miracle or a hidden miracle. Number two, it's a military miracle. The Rav argued the small Israeli army fended off attacks from large Arab nations. That's God knocking on the door, calling us to act. Number three, theologically, the notion of a Jewish nation rejected by God that will never get back to its former glory is repudiated by the emergence of the state. We are no longer downtrodden. In fact, we have returned. So that's a repudiation of the Christian and Muslim philosophies that the Jew was meant to be downtrodden and ridiculed for eternity. Number four, he saw it, and this I think is something that we can question whether it applies nowadays. He saw it as a miracle and is incredibly significant in terms of his effect on assimilated youth. That those youth who feel that disconnected from their Jewish identity, feel ashamed to be Jewish, many feel connected now because of the state of Israel. They feel proud to be Jewish because of the state. Now, nowadays, I'm not sure that's necessarily true for the assimilated youth. Maybe it's the opposite, but this is what the Rav argued. Number five, self-defense. The fifth knock, the significance of the state of Israel, is that Jewish blood isn't cheap. That for now and evermore, people know that if Jews are persecuted, then there will be someone to answer for that persecution. And finally, it's a refuge. And here's a direct quote. A Jew escaping from an enemy's land now knows that he or she can find refuge in the land of his or her forefathers. So these are six areas, again, politically, militarily, theologically, in terms of not being downtrodden forever, in terms of combating assimilation, in terms of self-defense, and in terms of providing a refuge. These are the six knocks that Rabbi Soloveitchik outlines for us in this speech. My question for you is, do you think these points are religious in nature? Do they effectively convey a religious outlook on the state? What do you think? Do you see here an incredibly theologically significant statement about how amazing Israel is? Or is this basically secular? What do we think?
More consistent with his practical approach to things.
100%, right? And this is what disappoints many people. It's very pragmatic. It's very pragmatic. He's not talking about Mashiach. He's not talking about some sort of expression of spiritual values. He's talking very practically. It's going to give people a certain amount. And it's very similar in this speech, at this point in the speech, it's very similar to Rabbi Reines. In a certain, it gives people, it's nationalism. It gives people chizuk, it gives people encouragement and strength. We're protecting people. And it's amazing that the politics worked out and we defended ourselves, maybe theologically, but it's not. It's a bit disappointing if you're looking for a statement as to how, as a Jewish person who wants to serve God, the state of Israel is going to inspire me to be a better servant of God, you might feel that this is lacking. And that leads us to a different talk that the Rav gave that I think really does...
Rabbi Bergman.
Yes. Yes, Andrew.
With point number three.
Yeah.
How can one reach the conclusion that he was being secular in his approach?
You're right. So you're 100% right.
It's
not
secular. I think what he was doing is he was soft pedaling the divine to those that would not necessarily be willing to digest it in those terms.
That's totally fair. Totally fair. You're saying that if you are very religious, you know, then that's one thing. Rabbi Soloveitchik is even talking to a secular audience.
This is for mass consumption.
Right, that's fair. This was actually a speech given to Mizrahi, or to Yeshiva University, actually. So it was a religious audience, but I hear what you're saying. And it's definitely religious in a certain sense, but it doesn't speak to the religious nature of Israel inherently. It doesn't say that Israel as a state, apart from anti-Semitism, apart from assimilation, apart from sort of the challenges of the exile, it doesn't speak to an inherent religious significance to Israel.
Robert,
I think it might. I think it might because I would say, what is the point of all these six points anyway? Because there is another solution for the Jews. The other solution is to assimilate amongst the nations.
Right.
Who needs the state of Israel? We really don't need it. I mean, that's one way of thinking. So
I think you would argue that just to sort of cut you to answer that, because I do want to sort of go on. There's a lot to say here. I feel like I'm taking too much time to introduce this.
I just wanted to make the point that all this is because of the fact that there is something very powerful behind it all. There is something behind the curtain that causes him to make these six points, and that is the divinity of Israel and the religious values. That's the reason, because if it's not for that, why not go and assimilate? Just to be a cultural Jew? Is that a good reason?
Right. So There's two answers to that. And I do want to go on and get to some of the crux of this. But I want to make three points. One is that I'm not arguing that Rabbi Soloveitchik doesn't see this as a religious obligation. I think Rabbi Soloveitchik's whole point here is that we have to give thanks to God. See this as an incredible blessing of God's loving kindness to us. See the divine providence behind all of these things, and that itself is religious, and therefore act and continue to support the land of Israel. That's for sure. So it's not secular in that sense. But in terms of the divinity of the state and the problem of assimilation, I would make two points. One is the argument of Zionism on a pragmatic level is assimilation ain't going to cut it. You can assimilate as much as you want. They're still going to hate us. That was Herzl's argument. We've tried assimilating. It didn't work. They still hated us. We became part of the, you know, intellectual community. We went to universities. They still hated us. They still wanted to kill us. So that's one point. In terms of divinity of the state, I'd like to define what that means for Rabbi Soloveitchik. What does it mean, divinity of the state, in the sense that you mean it? So here's where I'd like to go, and I'm sorry, I'm going to call up questions for a bit, to the other speech. This was recently translated by in an article in Tradition. You have the link here. And it's a speech Rabbi Soloveitchik gave in 1948, immediately following the founding of the State of Israel. And it's incredibly significant. And I think you see that on the one hand, he does see it as a means to an end, but it's a really important means to an end. There's a specific vision that Rabbi Soloveitchik sees within the State of Israel and its potential. And I'm going to go over it briefly again. Please go look at the whole speech. It's really wonderful. There's a lot of Torah in it. But let me try to get to the main kernels here. I don't know if we'll try to move through this a bit quickly. I know it's a bit tedious. So it starts off as follows. Rabbi Soloveitchik focuses on the notion of the divine presence in exile, the Shekhinah Begaluta. This is a concept that's talked about in many sources, in the Gemara, in the Bavli, the Yerushalmi. It's a mystical idea. But Rabbi Soloveitchik asks, for us, for the non-mystics in the room, which I will count myself under, I am no expert in Kabbalah, how are we to understand the notion of the Shekhinah in exile, divine presence in exile? What does that mean? And he's not going to start saying all these messianic ideas. He argues about that there's three aspects to it, and I'm going to elaborate on a few of them. Three aspects for the divine presence being in exile. Number one, what he calls defilement of the Shekhinah. Defilement of the Shekhinah becoming impure. In Rabbi Soloveitchik's worldview, and he's not thinking in mystical categories, he's thinking in halachic legal categories. In Rabbi Soloveitchik's worldview, that means in exile, religious observance is compromised on a practical level. It's harder to keep mitzvot, Torah, kashrut, Shabbat. It's harder to keep those things in exile when there is pressure to do otherwise. That's one. Two, the other aspect's more fundamental. I want to focus on that. The diminution of the Shekhinah, the constriction. And here Rabbi Soloveitchik talks about the fact, and I think it's really important, that we don't get the full perspective of what Judaism is meant to be. That we see our tradition and religion as an incredibly limited set of rituals that we do every once in a while. We don't get the full perspective of what Torah is meant to accomplish. And here is what he writes. In exile, even in the most religious and ideal circumstances, even when the Shekhinah does not become impure, people are very religious, they're very observant. She contracts and is reduced. This contraction is due to the fact that man lives not only within his own private domain, but is also part of a society and a community. The more life becomes modernized, the more constrained the domain of his intimate private life, while conversely, public social life expands. Piety in countries where one is a minority means being pious only in his private personal life. Shabbat, family purity, kashrut, surrounded by the curtains of one's home sanctuary. It is completely impossible to represent such a life as an embodiment of a full and complete Torah. My social economic existence is linked to the general political economic structure, which is based on other principles. And he gives a really important example. I think this is really important. Just generally and specifically in this context, many people think there's religion and then there's really important questions of morality and ethics and social justice. And many young people see those as disparate. They see that there's religion and that's something that you do in a synagogue and it's about praying and whether I believe in God or not, that's religion. And then there's more important things like ethics, like, you know, justice, ensuring that there's equity and we take care of the poor and the oppressed and the sick and dealing with conflict. And Rabbi Soloveitchik argues the reason people see it that way is because they don't get the full expression of Judaism. The Torah has a system of dealing with these issues on a societal level. We have laws that deal with conflict. with monetary disputes. We have mitzvot that deal with supporting those who are oppressed, the widow and the orphan, and people who are mired in poverty. We have all of those. The problem is we don't get to express them because our Torah is limited in exile, because we don't have properly functioning Jewish courts. We don't have a properly functioning Torah polity. We don't have the full swing, the full array of all the intrapersonal laws that can be affected by a community. And because of that, people have a very limited glimpse of Judaism. And that's the diminution of the Shekhinah. They don't get to fully experience what God means to offer us through the Torah. And he then writes, Rabbi's religious Zionist ideology is based upon the equation of the exile of Israel with the exile of Shekhinah. Religious Zionism means that, and this is the modern Mizrahi, means we have to realize that as long as we are not in our our homeland, and then religion is lacking. It cannot be fully expressed.
Rabbi Bergman.
That's the second point. Andrew, you know what? I really want to take your question, but I feel like I have a lot to get to. So would you mind holding it just for maybe, you know, until we at least cover the speech, and then I'm happy to take it. Is that okay? Maybe it's okay. Maybe not, but I'm just going to hold off here. Thank you so much, Andrew. I appreciate that. So that's point number one. Point number three is something else where Salvechik said, which is Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah, that the exile of the Shekhinah results in idolatry. And we had many different prophecies about how when the Jewish people go into exile, it results in idolatry. And Rabbi Salvechik expands the notion of idolatry, that it's not simply bowing down to a statue or to the stars or to the moon. Idolatry means worshiping something or having a relationship that is only meant for God with something other than God. And look what he writes here. It's very strong. Feeling complete dependence on someone, whether in a positive or the negative sense, is idolatry. Such a false relationship is not only a sin of the individual, but can also become a sin of the collective. A people's deification of a public figure through having absolute confidence in him or despair on account of him, at a moment when people's very destiny is determined, can be transformed into a tremendously negative force, which is Avodah Zarah. And Rabbi Salvechik argues that dependence on the mercy of foreign governments, dependence on if we're good, if we assimilate, if we acculturate ourselves, then they're going to like us. If we ask really nicely, then the secular foreign governments are going to allow us to return to our homeland. That is a form of idolatry. And that is a symptom of being in exile, of not having self-confidence in who we are, of feeling the need to depend on others. And that doesn't mean you're a Salvechik argument. It doesn't mean we can't engage in politics and we can't negotiate. And it doesn't mean we can't ask for favors every once in a while, but complete dependence, feeling like we're in trouble if other external, secular, foreign governments don't legitimize our right to sovereignty, that is a form of idolatry in the thought of Rabbi Salvechik. And that certainly has implications for the way we think about our nation and our state today. And so Rabbi Salvechik in the speech asked the following question. If these are the three symptoms of the Shekhinah in exile, then the question is, what does redemption mean? Because if the Shekhinah, if God follows us into exile, he must also return with us through redemption. And Rabbi Salvechik argues, it could be, it's true, that now that there is a state, we, in some sense, will be liberated. But the question is, will God be liberated along with us? And I'll read to you a bit of his quote here. We need to stop and examine this assertion of purpose, of direction, of an ideal. What is it? The answer is simple. The state of Israel will liberate a segment of the Jewish people from exile in the political, social sense. Naturally, not everyone will be redeemed through it. And he says, even in Yitzhak Mitzrayim, even the Exodus did not free all the Jews from Egypt. Exile is a subjective concept. The new Jewish state, we Jews have at least been given the opportunity, and that's the word here. The state of Israel is an incredible opportunity to liberate ourselves from exile. It's not automatic. But will the Ribono Shel Olam himself also be free from exile by the state of Israel? Or will he remain in captivity in the Jewish state? This is the main question we religious Jews have been asking ourselves for the past several months. Here is the charge to the religious Zionist camp. Our job just begins now. Our job with the founding of the state is just beginning to do what we can to make sure that the Jewish state, and I'm being careful with my words here, expresses Jewish values, that it results to some degree in expanding the full experience of what it means to live as a Jew. That's what it would mean to liberate the state, to liberate the Shechina. And here is where he has, again, a three-pronged vision of what that would mean. And he expresses confidence in the first. He says, you know, in terms of, and this is a really important idea. Let me make it a bit of a side here. And this Rabbi Soloveitchik notes, practically applying the halacha in the state is super complicated. It is not easy. And a Jewish democratic state is going to have to juggle with exactly how to apply halacha. But he says, I'm not so worried about that. To whatever degree it's so, I'm confident that the Jewish state will feel more Jewish. There, you know, the army provides kosher food. There are many things closed on Shabbat. He says Santa Claus's beard is less white. You walk around in all the holidays in Israel. Many, many people are celebrating. You see Sukkot. On a practical level, the purification of Shechina, i.e., practical observance of mitzvot, is certainly enhanced in the state of Israel. But here are the two questions that Rabbi Soloveitchik asks. The spread of the Shechina. Will the divine values of Torah express themselves in all areas of public and private life? And here's what he means. I'm going to focus on the second paragraph. However, the social, political, economic life of Israel needs to be expressed via the seal of Judaism, of Jewish law and morality. The various phases of state life must be permeated with Jewish spirit, understood and interpreted by Torah and spiritual giants. Our treasure of halacha regarding laws between man and his fellow man, from the laws of damages, the laws of kings, must be built and transformed into action and facts. And let me use a metaphor that Rabbi Soloveitchik employs. Rabbi Soloveitchik argues that just like you have a Torah, the letters of Torah, the ideas of Torah, and then you need a parchment to write the letters on the Torah. Without a parchment, a physical parchment, to store the letters of Torah, there is no place for Torah. Rabbi Soloveitchik sees Israel, the state of Israel, in the same way. The state of Israel can be a parchment for these Torah values. And he says, true, I have not put much thought into it, but I am convinced that when the Israeli social political institutions embody the Torah's ideal civil code, we will be the most advanced state in regard to social justice and truth. What Rabbi Soloveitchik is saying here, I think, is not, and Rabbi Holter makes the same point, he's not arguing that all of a sudden, you know, snip, snap, everyone's going to keep halacha. That's not the argument. The argument is that every single state needs to deal with issues of justice and, you know, monetary laws and civil law. And we have a treasure trove of Jewish values that speak to those questions. And Israel needs to be a place that expresses our perspective on these issues. And we need to learn and do the work and figure out how we can call Jewish values from our tradition and now begin to think about applying them on a statewide level. So it's about the values, not just the practical observance. You know, it's not just an itemized lists. And he writes, the task is a huge one. It is huge because it will not go as fast or as easily as I speak. First, a great deal of research is needed to consider modern problems in light of Torah Judaism. And think, I want to contrast this with the realism with Cook's sort of idealism. Whereas Cook said, when everybody goes back to Israel, snap your fingers, there's going to be a Sanhedrin. Everything is just going to be grand. Everything is going to be solved. Professor Halevi says, no, no, no. It is going to be hard and difficult, but it can be done. We have the material, but it needs to be processed and brought into practical life, into the relationship between employer and employee, strikes, unionism. All these things can be addressed via the Torah in a Jewish state in the land of Israel. And here's the last point that I want to focus on in terms of the process. For Rav Soloveitchik, the state itself needs to be an expression of our devotion to God and only God. But if not, it can be the opposite. And if we don't treat it carefully, the state could be avodah zara in and of itself. He says, don't make the state the be all and end all. It has to be seen as the importance of bringing about our national vision. But as violent and historically important as the state may be, it should not become an avodah zara. By this, I caution against an axiology which values the state as the highest, most precious, and greatest value in Jewish life. That the most important thing, no, perish the thought that someone should say, the most important thing about Jewish life is that we have a state of Israel. That would be avodah zarah, says Rav Soloveitchik, for which everything must be dedicated and sacrificed. Such a political philosophy is generally universally dangerous, but especially so for eternal Israel. The state can be a blessing through which Knesset Yisrael can revive itself. She can also become a curse. It just depends on how we think about and value it. I want to formulate my idea clearly and briefly. Here's the point. Statehood is important, not as a goal, but as a means. The goal transcends statehood, time, and history. I do not want you to misunderstand me. I do not underestimate the value of political sovereignty. I'm just opposed to a cult of sovereignty. No idol must be made of the land of Israel itself. She must serve a higher objective. What is this objective? A Knesset Yisrael, which represents not just any political nation, but a Torah nation, a kingdom of heaven nation, which is not limited to territorial borders. If the concept is properly understood, deepened, and enhanced by the Jewish state, and I am sure we will end up welcoming the Messiah. But if it will become a cult of absolutism and all Judaism in the state is diminished, then God forbid, we will have lost everything, both the state and Knesset Yisrael. So Rabbi Soloveitchik is, on the one hand, saying the state shouldn't be made into the be-all and end-all. It is a means, but it's a really, really important means, not just to combating anti-Semitism, not just to protecting ourselves, not just to providing a safe haven and a refuge, but for providing the environment in which the Jewish people can realize their full identity as a kingdom of heaven, as Knesset Yisrael, as a nation with Torah values. That is the religious Zionist vision for Rav Soloveitchik. And that's why the work is just beginning. And he argues that education is key, not just in Israel, but in the diaspora. We have to build institutions which educate the people about our national vision, about what being Knesset Yisrael means. So with that, unfortunately, I think I'm going to have to skip over this, the other speech of Kol Dido Fake, where he argues in a similar notion. He argues in a different way, very briefly, where Soloveitchik argues that in Kol Dido Fake, that as a people, we have a dual identity. On the one hand, anti-Semitism is real, and our experience as a people is very much affected by what we have gone through. There's what he calls the covenant of fate. The covenant of fate means that we have gone through so much as a people, and that changes the way we look at the world. It's what's forced upon us by history. But there's another covenant. That's the covenant of destiny. That's where it's not just negative, not just defensive, but offensive. That's where we make our history, where we have a vision for what we want to become. We are not just the people who are persecuted, but we are united by a shared vision. And Israel, the state of Israel, must combine both the national vision of covenant of faith, of a people who had been persecuted, but also of a covenant of destiny, of a people who have a shared vision for what they want to accomplish. So let me briefly, at this point, do the following. I want to summarize what we've seen. As you see, it's hard to see over here. I want to summarize what we've seen. I see you can't really see the stop, but I want to sort of, you know what, I have a chart here sort of depicting the differences between the various ideologies. I see that the Zoom thing is sort of blocking it. I'm not sure how to stop it from blocking it. So let me just tell you, the first column is Rukuk. And I think this illustrates sort of the difference between the ideologies. And I'll email you the PowerPoint slide. But let me highlight a few here. The state and redemption. We have three perspectives. Rukuk argues the state is a vehicle for bringing about the final redemption. That was Rukuk's argument. From Reines' argument that has no connection to redemption. Rabbi Soloveitchik's argument is it potentially could be a vehicle for redemption. It depends what we do with it, right? Let me make one more point here, and I will email the slide to anyone who would like it. The religious significance of the state. In what way is the state of Israel religiously significant? For Rukuk, it is significant, and for his followers, it's significant in that it's here to bring the redemption and to unite the nation and divine ideals. Rukuk speaks in terms of spiritual forces, and it's there to unite all the spiritual forces latent in the secular and religious. That's what it's here to do. Rabbi Reines argues that it's the environment for safeguarding the physical and spiritual being. It's there is because it's a religious value to ensure our survival. Rav Soloveitchik argues differently. 3 points. It is a refuge in self-defense. There's a mitzvah settling the land, but most importantly, it's a place where the full vision of a Torah lifestyle can be realized. So I think this hopefully, I know I went a little fast, hopefully portrays a few of the lines of thinking in terms of what it means to be a religious Zionist. As we go on in the series, now I'd like to tackle some specific points. Next week, I want to talk about the three oaths, the Gemaras about, which talk about not specifically taking the land of Israel by force, to talk about things such as dealing with land for peace and are we allowed to sacrifice land for peace, about questions like dealing with a secular populace in a land. All these questions, I think, will flow from these perspectives. How you answer these questions depends on your orientation in terms of what it means to have a religious state of Israel. And so I'm excited to explore those as we go on. Thank you very much for joining. And I'm happy to take a question or two before.
I have a question, please.
Yes.